All right, I have not yet checked to make certain that the video system is working for recording us. I therefore, just to play safe, have my phone recording us. So everything you say will be accessible to me and the National Security Agency, and who knows who else. All right. Yeah, well, when you go out, you can give me my office hour forms. Pick up one copy of that sheet of paper, if you would. That's for telling me what my office hours should be. And there's a seating chart that ought to be still circulating, and just keep circulating it until it's all full. All right. I wanted to start out by asking whether you had any questions on the mechanics of the course, on things like when you're supposed to hand in papers and what we're doing and that sort of stuff. Yes. Everything to be footnotes.
I won't. Footnote.
I don't care, as long as I can tell. Oh, one thing, a couple of people emailed me, I'm not sure whether from this course or the other course, who were concerned with the fact that the syllabus did not have an entry for every day of class. And they were wondering if that meant the class didn't meet on some days. What it means is that the syllabus only has entries for days when there's a reading assignment. And sometimes we have one assignment which covers a whole week, and then I have usually it's there for the first day of class and not the second day. So assume the class is meeting at all times when the class would normally meet unless told otherwise. Yes?
I noticed when I was reading Tuesday, that some of the links in the website were dead and no longer
linked. The only link that I know that is dead and that I fixed this morning was the link to the table of contents. No, that's the other course, sorry. So, the answer is email me about it, and then I can fix it. And I will try. I may get around. Maybe this evening I will check that. I was looking at the other web page and was discovered a broken link. Basically, when I teach a course successive years, I more or less copy over the web page and then try to fix everything, and sometimes I don't fix everything. Other questions on mechanics? All right. Any questions on what we talked about last time, which was sort of a introduction to the economics of property and of intellectual property? And the subject is a general subject, that it's not only the question of what should be intellectual property, but also should land be private property? If it is, what rights should go along with it and so forth? But we're applying those ideas to intellectual property. Any questions on the two chapters of my book that you have now all read for this class? All clear as mud. Wonderful. All right. I thought I ought to spend some time talking about the idea of economic efficiency, because it's an idea that's implicit or explicit in a lot of the economic discussion of intellectual property, and quite a large part of the discussion of intellectual property is put in terms of economics. And the idea of economic efficiency comes from the problem of how do you decide whether some change that affects a lot of people is a good thing or a bad thing? How do you sort of add up effects? And the metaphor that people like to use is to say the size of the pie. If we extend the term of copyright or extend the term of patent, does the size of the pie goes up or down? If in some sense of extending the term of patent provides a benefit to inventors, it might provide a benefit to the users of inventions if it results in more inventions. It also provides a cost to the users of inventions because they've got to pay license fees for longer and so forth. How do we decide if it's a good thing? That's the question. There is no good answer to that question. But there is a not too bad answer that economists in fact use. And that answer goes back, I think, to a man named Alfred Marshall, who more or less put together modern economics about 100 years ago. And his answer was to say, let's measure the effect on everybody by willingness to pay. So you say to somebody, it's really an imaginary calculation, not a real poll. But the question is, I'm an inventor. Assuming I knew everything involved in my alternatives, how much would I pay to have the term of patent extended by a year? That's a measure of the value to me of getting that change. You are a user of inventions. How much would you pay to either have it extended or reduced, or not extended, depending whether you're for or against it? And you could think of any change. And this is an example in patents. But if you imagine, let us say, putting up a tariff on automobiles, and you could have a sort of an imaginary calculation where you say, everybody who's benefited by the tariff, how much would each of them pay to get the tariff if it was all his decision? Everybody who's hurt, how much would he pay to stop it? And you can then say, well, to benefit is a plus, to stop it is a minus, add them up, if the sum is positive, there's a net gain. Alright? And that's the guts of how economists use economic efficiency. And there are several ways of evading the problems with this, of pretending that you're not really doing this. None of them work very well, and I can discuss them with people if they're interested. But basically, you can think of it, how many people know what the term utilitarianism means? Boy, not a lot of philosophers in the room. Utilitarianism was a 19th century philosophy which said, roughly speaking, that the right measure of the good was whether total human happiness was increased. And there are different variants, average human happiness, total human happiness. You could have a utilitarianism that included animals as well, though it usually didn't, and so forth. But the basic idea is that the one objective, if you want to sort of think of getting all of good and bad into a single objective, the sum total of human happiness, which was called utility, was the right measure. And not very many people are utilitarians. Certainly I'm not, in the sense of saying that's the only thing that matters, but it's pretty clear that it's the big thing that matters. And if it's a thing that we know more about how to deal with than other things, it might make sense to try to maximize it, even if that's not the only thing that's important. And you can think of Marshall's criterion of efficiency as a sort of approximate utility measure. That how much you're willing to pay for something is a measure of how much better off it thinks that you think it makes you. How much you're willing to pay to stop something is a measure of how much worse off you think it makes you. And considered from that standpoint, there are several obvious things wrong with it. First, you might be wrong. Imagine, for example, that we're thinking about drug legalization. From the economist's standpoint, the question you want to ask is, consider all of the people who want to use heroin. How much would they be willing to pay to be able to use heroin? Consider all the people who want other people not to be able to use heroin, how much would they be willing to pay added up? And that's assuming that the heroin addict's desire for heroin gets the same category as the diabetic's desire for insulin. All right? That is, it's saying we are accepting people's their own value for things rather than trying to sort of get above them and say, is it good for you or bad for you? And a lot of people don't want to do that. This is partly the argument over what's called paternalism, which is, should the state make decisions for you in your own good, right? You can think of one reason why a government might make laws is to keep you from hurting him, but another reason which people make laws is to keep you from hurting you. That's what's referred to as paternalism. And if you really accept sort of the full-bore economic model, paternalism makes no sense because we accept your evaluation of everything for yourself. Most of us don't fully accept it. Most of us who are parents think that our children sometimes make mistakes about what's good for them. Some of us even think that we sometimes make mistakes about what's good for us. So that's one objection to the criterion of economic efficiency, that it's accepting people's own values. A second objection is that it's assuming that you can do comparisons between people in dollars. And it's pretty obvious if you think about it that some people are willing... If you're a billionaire, the fact that you're willing to pay $1,000 for something doesn't show it makes you very much happier. It probably makes you a little bit happier. If you're very poor, the fact that you're willing to pay $2 for something is evidence that it makes you a lot happier. So one possible objection to the efficiency criterion is that it's adding up dollar values as if they were utility values, so to speak. And a third objection is that maybe human happiness isn't all that matters. That's really the criticism of utilitarianism in general, so that somebody might say what really matters is what God wants, not what we want. That would be one criticism. Somebody might say what's really important is whether a civilization produces great art. And whether people are happy, maybe we produce more great art if the artists are miserable and working very hard or something. Someone might say it's not man that matters, it's nature that matters. The sort of extreme environmentalist version really says human beings are a mistake. The earth would be better off without them because we mess everything up. Well, that clearly, whether right or wrong, is rejecting the idea that, you know, human happiness is all that matters. So you can think of a number of possible objections to the efficiency criterion. And I think the defense of it, the defense at least I would give, let me respond to those. Let me start with Marshall, because Marshall was a utilitarian. And Marshall's view was that it's true that money values are not a perfect measure of utility, but that most of the policies we're considering aren't policies that help rich people and hurt poor people, or vice versa. Most of them are policies that help a sort of a random mix of people, all the inhabitants of London, and hurt a random mix of people, all the inhabitants of York, say. And that when you have a random mix of people, the difference in value of money is going to average out across them. So probably the policy that maximizes dollar-measured happiness, as it were, probably measures real happiness, maximizes real happiness as well. So that was really Marshall's point. Yes?
That works best with the income distribution.
I don't think so. It really depends on there not being a correlation between income between the income and the effects of your policy. And so the part of the reason that economists may find that more persuasive than other people is that economists, or at least economists who do law and econ, think that the redistributional effect of legal rules is much less than other people think. That if you have a rule, if you have a legal rule which says landlords have to give poor tenants 6 months' notice before they evict them, say, which looks like a rule that helps poor people. But you say, but wait a minute. Once that rule is in place, landlords know the rule is there. That makes them less willing to rent to poor people because it's going to be hard to evict them if they don't pay their rent. That means that the cost of rent paid, the amount of land poor you'll have to pay to rent apartments becomes higher than before. So it's not really clear whether you're helping poor people or hurting them. And if you think of sort of any legal rule that predictably advantages one party to a voluntary transaction like renting an apartment, you can see that the advantage is going to partly or totally or more than totally going to be outweighed by the shift in the price of that transaction. All right? Does that make sense? Yes? No? Yeah?
I was thinking more when we're talking about dollars as
being yes.
representative
yeah.
utility, they're bidding a lot of money in this picture. Then is that more accurate when there's a kind of a bell curve distribution
Why would it be? That is, I don't see why it depends on whether it's shaped as a bell curve, because whatever the curve is, we would expect that on average the people with the higher incomes would probably have less utility per dollar than the lower incomes.
Right, but then kind of it'll
balance out because there's but if the policy you were considering helped people at this end and hurt people at this end, then it's not going to balance out. Whereas if the distribution wasn't a bell curve, but the policy randomly affects people all the way across, then it will balance out. Now there's a different defense of it. I should say I actually know one utilitarian. I haven't seen him for many years, but he is a Vietnamese-Australian economist called Quang Ung, very bright guy. And he had an interesting argument, which was a different defense of efficiency as a proxy for utility. And his argument is that you can always redistribute income by taxing rich people and giving money to poor people. What, from a utilitarian standpoint, what limits your willingness to do that? The fact that there are costs, that the rich people in practice are going to lose more dollars than the poor people gain, partly because people, when you tax people, people spend resources trying to make sure that they don't get taxed. When you subsidize people, people have less incentive to work because they can get a subsidy instead and so forth. So there's some deadweight burden to transfer. And a utilitarian would say you should do your transfer until the utility gain just balances the deadweight loss. All right, so if you get to the point where it costs, where transferring to a rich person to a poor person, ultimately the rich person loses $100, the poor person gets $50. If the utility per dollar is more than twice as high for the poor person, that's still a gain. If it's less than twice as high, it's a loss. So you should keep making the transfer until you reach the point where the next dollar you transfer will cost you just as much to transfer as the utility gain from it. That's Ung's argument. Now Ung says, suppose that instead of redistributing by an income, by taxing and giving people money, we redistribute by writing legal rules that favor poor people over rich people. That will have the same deadweight effect, because it makes it more attractive to be poor, so therefore less incentive to make money, less attractive to be rich. In addition to the deadweight effect, if these are inefficient rules, if these are rules where the rule itself costs $10 to get $9, it's got to be worse than doing a direct tax and transfer. Therefore, even if you are a pure utilitarian, which I think Gung is, and have no objections to redistributing income, the right way to do it, he's arguing, is directly rather than indirectly. Yeah, that was an interesting argument. Some other much better known law and econ people reinvented that argument like 20 years after he did, but they didn't know it until I told them. Anyway, so that's a possible defense. Going back to the argument that people may not know their own welfare, the response is, what better method do we have? That after all, if we aren't going to base the way the system works on what you think things are worth to you, someone else has got to decide what they're worth to you. That someone else knows less about you than you do. And perhaps more important, he has less incentive to care about you than you do. That's sort of one of the arguments for letting people make decisions for themselves, is that we can usually trust people to at least make the decision they think is in their own interest. Whereas if I'm making a decision for you, I'm going to decide that it's clearly in your interest to pay me more money to teach this course, because then I will be happier and will do a better job of teaching the course, and you may not think so, but that's just your ignorance. All right. So there's a general problem when you have people making decisions for other people of how you get it in their interest to make the right decision. Maybe the strongest argument is that maximizing dollar-measured utility, so to speak, maximizing efficiency, is something we have at least some idea of how to do. That, after all, the value to you in dollars of things gets revealed by your actions, by what prices you're willing to pay, what prices you're willing to accept for doing a job, and so forth. We don't have any utility meters which we can sort of attach to people's heads and say, how much happier would that make? So you can imagine institutional arrangements, and to some extent we have institutional arrangements, in which the dollar values are getting reflected in people's actions, and those actions are somehow feeding into the system and producing outcomes. And it's hard to see how you would do better than that. You know, if you have a benevolent, omniscient despot who's standing over there and can read all your minds, he could presumably do better than that, but that's not really a practical option in the world as it exists. All right, so in any case, I just thought that since implicit in a good deal that you'll be reading is this idea of what IP rules produce net benefits. And net benefit sounds like it's a well-defined idea, but it really isn't, as I've been trying to demonstrate. At least when the things are being written by economists, what they really mean is the value of the gains to those who gain, measured by the dollars they pay for them, more or less than the value of the losses to those who lose. All right? Questions? Comments? Anybody have any other objections, by the way, to economic efficiency? I gave what I see as the most serious ones, but there may be others that occur to some of you. No. And you can have a better criterion. So, yeah.
Just the sort of lack of any other sort of like consideration for morals or culture in it?
Well, that is obviously culture is going to affect what people value, but let me see if I can give an example of a critique of utilitarianism, not just efficiency. My standard example is, you're the sheriff in a small town, and there have been several very ugly murders, and the populace is getting really angry. And you're pretty sure that if nothing is done, they're going to lynch a couple of people. It happens that there is somebody who you can frame for the murder. You're pretty sure you can't find out who really did it. But there's a moderately unpopular guy, and you think that if you accuse him of the murder and do a little bit of convenient perjury, you can get him hanged. Well, it looks as though on a utilitarian ground you ought to do it, because after all, if you don't do it, two or three innocent people will be killed. This way, one innocent person will be killed. And yet most of us feel you shouldn't.
I think that's what I was talking about. It's like when we were into tort law, we were talking about cases like specifically the Pinto case, and where people try to quantify, you know, how much injury or death. I just think those numbers are unquantifiable, which kind of screws up the system.
But then what do you do? Does unquantifiable mean they're infinite? Because nobody asked. I don't believe it. That cannot be true. Do you ever drive a car?
Do you
spend all of your income on safety and efficiency?
No.
Then you don't believe that those things are infinitely valuable, do you? Isn't the appropriate, if you look at how people act, not how they say, People act as though their own life is very valuable. They don't act as though it's infinitely valuable because they choose to take risks. People accept risky jobs which pay better than somewhat less risky jobs. People choose to have their brakes checked only once every 2 years instead of every once every year. In deciding what car to buy, you don't make the sole criterion how safe it is. So all of that is evidence that life is of finite value.
I think that'd be more like people's cognitive dissonance that they don't think anything's going to happen to them. Because I know, when I go out and drive my car, I never think I'm going to get into an accident.
So you believe that anybody who thinks there's any chance greater than zero of an accident wouldn't drive. Does that describe human behavior as you observe it?
No, but I think people think there's a low chance.
That might be, but that all that tells you is that they may act. That may mean that our estimate of the value of life is off, but it doesn't mean it's infinite. Right? And it's an important point you're raising, because a lot of people have this reaction. And if you are a highway engineer and you are so imprudent as to say that in deciding whether to spend money banking this curb, which will make accidents a little less likely, we're assuming a value of life of $2 million. You shouldn't say that. People will get mad at you. But that's their fault, not your fault. Because you've got to make some such assumption. Maybe it should be 3 million. Maybe it should be 1 million. But you're not willing to say, spend all of the society's resources on making the world safer. As an individual, I'm reminded, it's a bit of a tangent, but there's a story about an American reporter who visits Hitler back before World War II. And Hitler is talking about how much his people love him. And Hitler says, look, they're on the ninth floor of a building in Berlin. And Hitler says, let me show you. And he calls one of the guards and says, the guard comes in, Heil Hitler. And Hitler says, Heil Hitler, jump out the window. And the guy goes to the window and opens the window and jumps out. And the American reporter looks down the window and there's this corpse on the ground. This is amazing here, Hitler. How much you're... And he goes, let me show you again. Calls in the next guard. Heil Hitler, jump out the window. Guy goes to the window. American reporter runs up, the guy grabs him. Don't you realize it's 9 stories down there? If you jump out, you're going to lose your life. You call this living? Jumps out the window. But in a sense, if you really spent all of your resources maximizing life expectancy, I don't think you would call it living. Thank you for making the point. It's an interesting point. Notice that one implication of the fact that people feel the way you feel, and a lot of people do, it's sort of a fairly normal attitude, is that given tort law, that may make it harder for companies like auto companies to actually evaluate risks. Because if the record shows that your engineers told you you can save $50 million at a cost of 2 lives, you are likely to get into serious trouble when somebody sues you. Which means that maybe that you may make it clear to your engineers that you don't want to hear that. And if you don't hear that, then in the case when it's only 5 million and 100 lives and you ought to make the improvement, you also don't hear it. So that's one of the problems with this. Let me keep on in the digression, because it's an interesting digression. One of the reasons for your instinct is that people say, look, what if somebody offered to buy your life right now? All right, I say, I need a heart transplant. How much are you willing to sell yours for? And the answer is, most people say no. But the reason they say no is not that your life is infinitely valuable. It's that money is worthless to a corpse. It's really the dividing by zero problem, not the multiplying by infinity. And if you think instead about the people who do accept those offers, people, soldiers who jump on a hand grenade, say, well, they are getting a payoff, saving their buddies' lives, which doesn't depend on their being alive to collect. So there's no sum of money for which they jump on a hand grenade, but there's something else they would. And similarly, in the case where you take only a risk of dying, if you have a 1% chance of dying, you have a 99% chance of being alive to spend the money. So people are willing to accept a 1% chance of death for a sufficiently high payment, but not 100%. Anyway. All right. So we've wandered pretty far. Other comments, questions on this idea of economic efficiency? If you're sufficiently curious There are at least two of my books that are available for free on the web that have longer discussions of this. The book that I've linked to chapters of Law's Order, one of the first couple of chapters discusses economic efficiency. And I have a price theory text, which you can find from my webpage, which is, well, I've given you at some point the link to that. And the price theory text has a long discussion of economic efficiency. So if you're really curious about the economics, yeah.
I guess another discussion might be that concept of utility can be so vague as that you can attribute to anything. And where do you know where to consider that to not? You know, whenever somebody acts in a certain way, what do you know that maybe they're not doing it in order to further utility?
Maybe, but the... In a sense, as long as it's the best measure we got about what makes them happy, it may make sense to use it, even if it's sometimes wrong. One should not make the best the enemy of the good, as somebody once said. All right. So then the question is, if the objective is to set up a set of legal rules, or anything else, but make it legal rules, because we're in a law school at the moment, which maximize total dollar measured utility, which maximize economic efficiency, how do you do it? And one way of putting it, if you're thinking about it in terms of an economic system running, is produce anything where the value to those who end up with it is greater than the cost of producing it, and everything that's produced go to whoever values it most. All right, that sounds like the rule that maximizes total benefit. Because if you produce something and the value is greater than the cost, there's a net gain. If you move something from somebody who values it at $10 to somebody who values it at $20, there's a net gain. And to first approximation, a simple system of property and trade does that. Because if the property rule is things belong to whoever create them, and if the trade rule is ownership changes by mutual assent, then when I produce something, I find in all the world the person who values it most, and I say, what are you willing to give me for it? If he's not willing to give me more than it cost me to produce it, then that was a mistake and I shouldn't have produced it. If he is, then I sell it to him. It ends up in the hands of the person who values it most, and I end up having made a gain by making the right decision. All right, so that's sort of a very, very simple and sketchy model of how an economy works, and obviously we've got layers of complication built on top of that, and there are various reasons why it doesn't always work that way, but it at least gives you a sort of a useful first approximation. And what are some of the ways in which it breaks down? And one of them is through transaction costs, through the fact that I can't actually find the guy who values it most in all the world, because there are whatever it is now, 7 billion people or 8 billion people or something in the world. I don't know all of them. But furthermore, they might lie to me. Let's suppose that I've got this really neat thing, and you actually value it at $100. But your guess is that it's not worth more than $50 to anybody else, though you're not sure. So when I come to you and say, how much is it worth to you, what do you say?
$52.
Right, maybe $51, depending on how risk-averse you are, but right. And maybe, however, there's somebody else who did that who really values it at $120. All right, so people may not give accurate information on what they value things at. I may not find the right person. So there are all sorts of implicit assumptions in making this model work perfectly about sort of everybody's fully informed, everybody's honest, and all the rest of it. Now, it turns out that there is a model which describes some parts of the economy pretty well, which solves this problem, and that's what we economists call perfect competition. And perfect competition is a situation where there are enough producers producing the same thing, so that each of them knows that how much he sells at what price won't affect the market price. So that I say, look, I can produce wheat at, cost me $10 a bushel to produce wheat. How much he will pay me for it? If it turns out that people are willing to pay $15 a bushel, I produce lots of wheat, but so does everybody else and the price comes down. And you end up at a price, which is a price at which I'll just produce, because if it was any higher than that, we'd be producing more. And at which people want to buy just the amount that we're producing, because if they wanted to buy more, they'd bid the price up, and less, the price would go down. That's, again, a very, very sketchy model of the economist's world of perfect competition. So in that world, the price that I can get for something measures the value to the person who'll get it. The price that I charge for things measures the cost to me of producing them. So at least in that simple world, you're actually getting things produced, if and only if they're worth producing. Let's go on to the opposite extreme, which is going to be relevant to this class because it's the extreme that's created by patent and copyright law, and that's monopoly. All right, so suppose that instead of having a million wheat farmers, we have one wheat farmer. Somehow or other, whether by law or some other activity, he's ended up the only person who produces wheat. And he says to himself, you know, I could produce another bushel of wheat for $10. But if I raise the price to $11, selling wheat at $10 a bushel is sort of a mug's game, because after all, it's what it costs me to produce. If I raise it to $11 a bushel, I'll sell a little bit less wheat, it's true, but now they're making $1 a bushel on each bushel. $12, $13. So what he's going to be doing in that case is calculating the trade-off between losing sales through higher prices and making more money through higher prices. All right? And there will, again, this isn't an econ course, we don't have to go through all the details of it, but he's going to find some price at which he maximizes his profit. That price is going to be higher than his cost of production. That means, suppose his cost of production is $10 a bushel, and his monopoly price is $15 a bushel, and you value wheat at $14 a bushel. Do you buy it? No. But if he grew one extra bushel of wheat and handed it to you, he'd be $10 worse off for the cost of growing it. You'd be $14 better off. Economic efficiency goes up by $4. Ditto if he grew a bushel of wheat and sold it to you for $14. He'd be $4 better off because it costs him $10 to grow. You'd be nothing better off. You're paying its exact value. Again, a net gain of $4. So how it happens will affect who gets the gain, but you're missing a gain, as it were. All of the people who value the good at something between its cost of production and its price don't get it, although getting it for them would produce a net benefit. And this is what's referred to as the deadweight cost of monopoly. And the reason that this is relevant to this course, I guess, should be pretty obvious, because what do patent and copyright do? They create monopolies. So if you think about the point we discussed Tuesday, what is the cost to me of somebody who otherwise wouldn't read my book making a copy and reading it? The cost is zero to me. What is the benefit to him? Well, it's a great book. He gets at least $1 worth of benefit out of it. The fact that I'm charging him $1.50 royalties and therefore he doesn't do it means that the society has lost an opportunity to make a net gain of $1. All right? Is that argument clear? Not clear? You can never tell when people aren't talking whether the reason is that it's all obvious or that it's completely opaque. So please stop me when it's not obvious. I realize stopping me is hard, but it can be done. All right. So that suggests that there is a cost to using patent and copyright, which is that we end up with a lower output of the good than would be ideal, with fewer copies of my book being made. Yes?
I'm having trouble conceptualizing how that benefit, so the opposite of the doing, if there's a society gains however much, how does that value get back to the community at large?
Because inventions get made that wouldn't be made otherwise. That is the argument, the standard argument for intellectual property, not the only possible argument, but the dominant argument, is that it provides an incentive to produce. So you get no return at all if I don't write the book. And so the argument is that we have a trade-off between the fact that those books that would be written anyway are getting read by fewer people because of the cost, but more books are getting written, or more inventions being made, or more. Think about drugs. Drugs are one of the cases where you have a pretty strong argument that it's costly to bring them to market, and therefore if you can't get a temporary monopoly, you'll never do it.
Okay. I guess what confused me was how it seems like you can sort of create an estimate or a number that quantifies the benefit to society, when I would see that as...
You're 15 minutes ahead of me.
Okay.
But you're right. That is to say, if you, putting it differently, again, it's useful to sort of imagine things with an imaginary, benevolent, wise social planner and say what he would do, and then ask how do we set institutions that can get as close to that as we can. And one of the problems he faces is how do we find out what the benefit is, or what the cost is, all right? Because we also don't know how many people value my book at a dollar and not a dollar 50 or whatever, right? So that one of the things you want is institutions that as nearly as possible generate answers to those questions and balance them, if that makes sense. And that's what you're trying to do, and you can't do it very well, but maybe we can do it better than completely worthlessly. So, in any case, so one problem with intellectual property law is the deadweight cost of the monopoly it creates. And the second problem, which came up earlier, are the transaction cost problems. So the case where I guess that's clearest is let's suppose that there's a book I'd really like to have a copy of, and conveniently enough the library has a copy so I can read the book, but I want my own copy. Unfortunately, the book is under copyright, and I do not know who holds the copyright. And it would be a considerable effort to find out. And it might be that the copyright holder would be perfectly happy to have me make copies, or would do it for 10 cents. But the effort of actually arranging the transaction is very high. And if you imagine the case, suppose we took a very strong version of copyright law, stronger than we have, in which quoting anything at all was a violation of copyright without permission. So I'm writing a book, and I want to quote a sentence from this guy, and a paragraph from that guy, and half a sentence from that guy, in order to make my argument, which is about how these ideas developed over the last 50 years. If I have to negotiate with 173 people in order to write my book, I never write the book. All right? So you can think of transaction costs as a second problem. That the advantage of one of the advantages of a commons is a situation where people just use stuff without anybody's permission, is that you don't have to arrange transactions. You can just go and do it. Let me give you a different example outside of IP, but one which I use in other courses, about the transaction cost problem. So think about the question of how we keep me from driving in ways that injure other people. And one way you could imagine doing it is to say that I'm only allowed to drive if I have permission from everybody whose cars I might dent. All right, that would be, if we imagine that everyone has an absolute injunctive right not to have the risk of having his car dented. It's a possible legal rule, not a very good rule, but it's a possible legal rule. And the problem with that legal rule is that before I pull out of the driveway, I need a unanimous contract with everybody in San Jose, Santa Clara, and surrounding communities. All right, cost of negotiating that contract is very high. So that suggests that we want some different rule. One rule could be a pure commons, which just says, if I dent you, tough luck. Another rule, the one we actually have, is tort liability, which is I don't need permission to impose the risk on you, but if the risk eventuates you, I owe you damages. All right? There are disadvantages to that. The disadvantage of that, going back to the question you were asking a minute ago with IP, is how do we find out what the cost to you of a dent or a broken arm or whatever happened to you is? Well, you could argue that the market solution, I've got to buy your permission in advance, at least your own values are being revealed, whereas the way we do it, some court has got to guess how bad it is. But on the other hand, the transaction costs of the market solution in that case are so horrendous that the tort solution makes an awful lot more sense. One could imagine, turn it around, the way in which we get use of cars is by a straight property rule. You could imagine a legal system where I'm in a hurry to get to the airport, I happen to have a rather odd background, so I know how to hotwire cars. And there's a car there. So I hotwire the car, I drive off to the airport, and then you sue me. You, the owner of the car, sue me for the inconvenience of not having the car. That's the equivalent of what we do for auto accidents, right? It doesn't work very well for cars. Why? Because transaction costs aren't very high. Hertz and Avis rent cars all the time. Companies sell cars all the time. Whereas the cost, the difficulty of determining the value of finding who had hotwired your car and so forth make that a very inconvenient arrangement. So you can think of a lot of these same issues. Part of the fun, for any of you who are ever thinking of taking my course in economic analysis of law or doing it somewhere else, part of the fun is the way in which it unifies the law, in which the economic perspective, you end up with the same arguments applying across tort law, criminal law, contract law, IP law, everything you can imagine. And that sort of is fun and interesting. If you don't want to take the course, you can just read the book. It's available for free. My books are a commons, at least as far as stuff online, except when my publisher won't let them be, which very occasionally happens. And actually, one of the books that my publisher doesn't control, which I didn't have as a commons because I wanted to try doing a Kindle, thought that would be fun. Anyway, so let's keep keep going. But in any case, I guess sort of the bottom line of this part of the discussion goes to the other book you're going to be reading parts of, the Baldwin and Levine book, because what they're arguing is that if you add up all of the costs of enforcing, of transacting and deadweight costs and the rest of it, it ends up that we're worse off with intellectual property. Their conclusion is that patents and copyrights make us worse off, not better off. Can you see what the other half of that has to be? One half of that argument is the claim that the costs of using intellectual property law to generate intellectual property are high. What's the other half of their argument going to have to be?
The benefits are low.
Which means, what does benefits low mean?
Intellectual property means to be created anyway.
That the argument has to be that there are other ways of getting it created. Because after all, however high the deadweight costs, if the result of not having patent and copyright was no inventions and no books, that's got to be worse than inventions and books with all sorts of problems. So their argument has got to be, and one of the next we'll be getting to, has got to be that there are other mechanisms for producing intellectual property which don't depend on a monopoly. And that's an interesting issue, not only in terms of the question of whether we should abolish patent and copyright law, but also on the question of how creators are going to function if technology abolishes it for us. All right, if you think about what's happened to music already, and is arguably happening to books, which is that when intellectual property exists in the form of digital files, it is very cheap to copy and very cheap and easy to distribute, and that makes it very hard to enforce copyright law. All right? So you might find that various parts of IP law simply get abolished under our feet, so to speak, with no legal changes at all, in which case these questions of how else you produce things become very important. Yeah?
But at the same time, the cost of doing all those things is going down as well, so a lot of stuff is still being created and put out there.
That is to say, that's right. That in, as I may have mentioned, I think last time, you can now self-publish at essentially very close to zero cost. And there are a huge, I mean, I may be wrong, but I would guess that of the Kindles up on Amazon, I doubt that 1% are paying a revenue of more than $100 a year to their authors. Maybe 2%, I don't know, a very small fraction. Now, of course, many of those 98% are trash. There's a reason they aren't, but not all of them are. All right. So yes. No, that's right. But in general, you're correct. Let me put it differently. There are really three questions you want to think about. One of them is how large are the costs of having intellectual monopoly. One of them is how good are the other ways of getting incentive to produce IP. And the third is how much incentive do you need? And there, if you think about movies, for example, I suspect that in another decade or two, it's going to be practical to make movies on your home computer with no actors. But as we get better, and I don't know how many people saw the Roger Rabbit, was a movie which interspersed digitally created actors with real actors. And I presume that as we get better and better at doing that stuff, we're going to be moving to technologies where you can, here's your plot, here are your imaginary actors who look like real actors. Yes? Does it? Yeah. It's not a technology I have any experience with. But basically, if you don't need actors, I actually have a very bit part in a very minor movie that somebody I know made. And I was amazed by how expensive it is to make movies. Just in terms of, this is a low budget movie. And I suppose for the day I was there, they had 50 people maybe, I'm guessing. But there were a whole bunch of people doing this and doing that and doing the other thing. And you can see that even really low budget movies are going to cost, I guess, typically millions of dollars unless you've got volunteers who are willing to work for free. And if it goes to the point where making a movie is like writing a novel, all right, what do you need to write a novel? Well, you need a word processor, and you need some ideas, and you need some time. But it doesn't require external. It'd be nice if you have an editor, depending on how good an editor you are. But it doesn't require external input. If making movies is like that, then maybe we'll be in a world where fairly small rewards will be sufficient to produce movies, and some of them might be good movies. But we'll also want to go on to what are the ways you get the rewards. Let me go back, though, to your question, which I'm now getting to. Maybe it's less than 15 minutes. And that is, How do you measure, how do you set what the reward ought to be? So you're the benevolent planner sitting up above the world, and you say, all right, this guy has written a novel. How do we decide how big a reward to give him? This guy has invented a new medical drug. How do we decide how big a reward to give him? And any ideas? So that would be one measure. One measure would be the amount people are willing to spend for it minus the cost of producing what they're spending on. So if you imagine the sort of pure case where what I'm producing is a novel which is going to be on the web, but imagine I can somehow enforce copyright law on it, which I really can't. But suppose I could, then it costs nothing for you to make a copy. So if I could ask everybody in the world what's the highest price you would pay to make a copy and they all told me the truth, the sum of that would be the value of my novel. I can't do it. All right. What can I do? I can set a price. I can say, all right, I charge $1 to copy the novel. Well, that tells you the number of people to whom it's worth more than $1 times $1. But it's leaving out the people to whom it's worth 50 cents because it cost me nothing for them to do it. So that's still a net gain potentially. But we're not getting it. And it's leaving out the people to whom it's worth $2 who are getting the benefit because they're copying it. They're only paying me $1. So the what I can sell it for is a measure of value, but it's a measure which first is too low because there are people who are ending up getting it for less than the highest price they would pay because I'm not a perfect bargainer. And the actual value produced is made lower by that mechanism because there are people who don't get it who still have some value for it. How else could you? You could imagine that the planner sort of tries to do some elaborate calculations, and he says, look, I'm going to take a random sample of readers and ask them how much they like the book, or this is a new drug, I'm going to try to figure out how much it increases the cure rates. So one possible approach, if I'm thinking of my benevolent planner, one possible solution would be prizes. And that's been done, of course, at various times. So you could imagine the famous historical example, probably the book probably discusses it, is that there was this real problem, when was it? It was probably, I'm guessing, about the 18th century, maybe the 17th century. And the problem is, how does a ship find out where it is? All right? You're sailing across the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean, and it would be really nice if you knew where you were, because it makes it more likely you'll get to where you want to go. How do you do it? With pre-modern technology, they don't have GPSs, no satellites, no artificial satellites. Anybody know how with pre-modern technology you figure out where a ship is?
Stars.
What will the stars tell you?
Where you are relative to, like the night sky is different in different parts of the Earth,
okay. In what kind of difference does it tell you and what doesn't it? Is the night sky different in San Jose than it is in New York?
Well, I know it's different from the southern and northern.
It's different in Sydney, Australia than it is in New York, all right. So none of you are... Yes? It tells you how far north or south you are, but it does not tell you how far east or west you are. Got it. That's why Sydney is different from New York, all right? It's got to be right. If you think about it, the Earth's rotating, all right? San Jose was, 4 hours ago... Or will be. I figure which direction is where New York is now. Right? It just turns around. It's the same sky. So in order to get the longitude, to get the east-west distance, what do you need? What is the one essential tool that makes it possible to do the second half of your navigation? Yeah? A clock. And a clock accurate enough so that it will tell you the real time and we'll keep doing it after being at sea for 3 months. All right? So if you have an accurate enough clock, you say, all right, I set the clock to Greenwich Mean Time. I know when sunrise is Greenwich Mean Time in Greenwich. For every 24th of the circumference of the Earth I go around, it shifts by an hour. So if sun came up 3 hours earlier or later than it would have at Greenwich by Greenwich Mean Time, that tells me that I am 3/24 of the circumference of the Earth around in one direction or the other. All right? That was their problem, and they knew that was their problem, and so the English government offered a large prize to anybody who could make a clock accurate enough to solve that problem. And there was then a lot, when somebody more or less did it, there was then a lot of litigation over who had or hadn't done it, whether he met the requirements and so forth and so on. But that's one possible approach. Anybody know the modern version of this? Yes.
I think the space
thing. The space prize has already been won. I'm sure there are others still going. But the original X Prize was a privately produced prize. All right, this was the private people who said, if you can achieve the following version of private spaceflight, defined as getting above some altitude, I think twice within, I don't remember the details, like, you know, within 2 weeks, getting a human being up to 100 miles above the Earth's surface and staying there for an hour, I'm making it up, but it's some criteria, like, you'll get $1 million. And now that was an interesting one, because $1 million is almost certainly much less than it actually cost people who did it. So in that case, part of what you're getting out of it is status. Part of what you're getting out is good publicity. And the prize makes a nice way of defining what you're trying to do and therefore getting the news headlines when you do it. Anybody know about the Mouse Prize? This one hasn't been won yet. This is by people who would like to live longer, which most of us would. And so it's a prize of a similar sort, which, if I remember correctly, requires some repeatable procedure which will double the lifespan of mice. That's, again, I'm sure it's got a more precise definition. But the basic idea is that they want to encourage research on life extension. And one way of doing it, very popular way of doing it, is you have some government agency who says, all right, we think you're the researcher, we'll give you money to do your plan. A different way, and in some ways a rather more attractive way, to say anybody can do it. All we want are results, right? When the government wants to buy pencils, they don't say, all right, you're the person who should make the pencils. They say, we'd like to buy some pencils, so sell them to us. So the prize, the Mouse Prize, is saying, we'd like to buy some knowledge about aging. Who will sell it to us? And somebody hopefully will win the prize. I hope so. I mean, I should say, at a tangent from a different course I teach, I think the odds are better than even that none of you is going to die of old age. I don't think the odds are that good for me, since I'm a lot older than you are. But I think at the moment we are all dying of an incurable disease, the one that's killed everybody before us, except the ones who died of something else, namely getting older and older. There is no inherent biological reason why people ought to get old. All right? The instructions for building your body are in every cell of your body. That's what the DNA has got. That's a massively redundant database. There's no way it's getting corrupted. So that means that if only you had good enough technology, you could keep rebuilding your body in perfect shape, you know, every 10 years. And I think my guess is you'll make it. But we'll see. Maybe I'm an optimist. I'm not that optimistic. My guess is I won't, but we'll see on that one, too. Anyway, but which is one reason, by the way, why how we encourage invention might be a life and death matter for all of us. Because if we do it wrong, then they're going to discover the solution to aging a year after you die. And if you do it right, it'll be a year before. Well, a year before you would have died. All right. So going on, if we go back then to the way we actually do it, the theoretical justification for our IP system is to say the best measure we've got of the value of innovation is what people are willing to pay for it. So therefore, we say, when you make an innovation, whether it's writing a novel or inventing something, we give you the right to forbid other people from using it. And we give it, and you can then sell the right for them to use it. That gives at least a crude measure of the value of your innovation. If your innovation is completely worthless, nobody's going to pay you for it. So you have no incentive to make it. If it's really valuable, you'll try really hard to make it because you'll get paid a lot. So it's not a perfect way, but it's not too bad a way. And that is a way in which you're generating an answer to the question that you were asking before. It's not a very perfect answer, but it's at least some measure of the value. But it's a costly way for the reasons we've already discussed. There are transaction costs of people licensing your invention. There are the deadweight costs of the monopoly price on the invention. How long should the monopoly hold for? Suppose, again, imagine you're the benevolent planner up in the sky, and you're saying, all right, he's made an invention. I'm going to reward him by saying he has a monopoly of that invention. How long should he have that monopoly for? Yes?
Until the amount of invention that is encouraged by its the benefit of the game. So once enough invention is discouraged by the monopoly, then that outweighs the benefit from having them athletes in society.
But we need some way of measuring that benefit. And our way of measuring the benefit is to give him a monopoly. And if the monopoly is for 1 year, it's going to give him less revenue than it's for 2 years or for 20 years or for 100 years. So how in principle we decide how many years, yeah?
No one is going to pay anymore.
Well, that would be one possibility. But of course, if nobody's willing to pay anything at all, then it doesn't matter if he has a monopoly anymore. Yeah?
In this discussion, are we saying that inventions in art should be covered under the same rule set?
Might or might not be. No, I'm just... I think there are reasons, as I discussed in the book, why patent and copyright ought to be different. But I just want to take any one of those things and how in principle, how do you decide how long a copyright should be? How do you decide how long a patent should be? How do you... If we're trying to measure the benefit due to my inventing something, and we say, well, the benefit is that the thing exists, that the invention is there that wouldn't have been there anymore otherwise, so we're going to try to see what that's worth by letting me sell the right to do it. Yeah?
Maybe the point at which it's hindering further creation of invention. For copywriting, because ideas aren't copyrightable, people can still use the same idea, still build on the same idea. Whereas
right. Well, but you can build on it as long as you're not infringing it, and you could build on it by licensing it.
True, but the cost is still significantly higher when you're not licensing that you like invention.
But if you, so I guess the question is, if you're trying to, yes, so you have a different answer. What? All right. I was going to say, if you're trying to sort of set up institutions for deciding how long patent protection would be, maybe different for different things, maybe all the same, what, you've got your research team, and you say, find out the answer to this question. What's the question you're going to ask them? That is, you're now suggesting a different approach than the one I'm describing, but it's one which is also would be workable under different circumstances. In a sense, there are two, we can imagine two models for getting something built. One of them is to say, what is the highest price we're willing to pay, namely the value of this thing? Let anybody who can do it for less than that do it. Another is to say, what's the lowest price for which anybody will do it? And set that price. So if you knew for sure that a novel would be written for a $10,000 reward, it wouldn't make any sense to offer a $20,000 prize. On the other hand, if you knew for sure that writing the novel was worth $20,000 for the readers, it would then make sense to say, we'll offer a $20,000 prize, we don't know what it costs to write it, but as long as it's anything less than that, it'll get written. So those are, in a sense, two different conceptual ways of trying to get the efficient outcome, whether you say, what does it cost to produce it or what is it worth? And so there's a certain sense in which you're going to ultimately want to combine them. That's going to take us a while because you're going to want to say, if we raise it from 19 to 20, how many more novels will be written? Well, that's really a question of how many people are there for whom it costs in that range. Well, what's the obvious limit to the benefit from my invention, inventing something? What is the point at which my inventing something produces no more benefit for anybody? Yeah?
If there's no more need for them.
That's one possibility, but in that case, it doesn't matter if I have a monopoly. What's the other point? Yeah?
I guess if nobody
uses it. How about when somebody else invents it? All right? That the result of my inventing something is not that from now to eternity it exists when it wouldn't have existed. The result of my inventing it is that it exists from now until the next person would invent it. So if you had something which was so obvious, those of you who know that patent law may know that non-obviousness is a requirement. If there's something so obvious that as soon as anybody really wanted it, in half an hour some clever person would invent it. Well, we probably don't want to give a patent for more than half an hour to that one. All right. Whereas if there is something so unobvious that it would take a million years for anybody else to invent it, well, then there's at least some argument for giving an eternal patent on the grounds that it keeps producing forever. So one of the questions you want to think about, and this is going to be relevant in particular to the patent versus copyright issue, all right, how long is it going to be before somebody else writes my novel? Yeah?
So you're talking independently?
Independently. You know, this is the old line that if you put a million monkeys in a million typewriters for a long enough time, they type out the plays of Shakespeare. And someone had a story where somebody actually does the experiment, and, you know, after 1,000 years, the best they've gotten is to be or not to be, that is the Gurgle Flux. And if you think about the odds of doing it, it's essentially forever, right? So that suggests that one reason you might want longer terms for copyright than for patent is that patent, the chance of parallel invention is much higher. Therefore, the invention may really have a much shorter useful lifetime before somebody else invents it, whereas the copyright, no such problem. Let me give you a different way of putting the same point. And this goes really back to my homesteading discussion last time. And that is, let me go even further back, because this is the point we actually come to. The book is going to discuss in the stuff you're going to read for next week. A political philosopher called John Locke wrote some stuff about the origin of property rights, which has been influential since. And what he says is that you obtain property in land by mixing your labor with the land. But he says there's a condition, what's called the Lockean proviso, as long as there is as much and as good left for other people. Because if you imagine an unlimited amount of unused land, then when I clear the trees and take out the boulders and plant stuff, all of that value I created. But if there's a limited amount of land, going back to my homesteading story, now I take 100 acres and I clear it. One result is there's 100 acres more of usable land, but the other result is 100 acres less for anybody else to clear. So therefore, if I got the full value of the land, I'm being over-rewarded because part of that value was there already. All right. Now, there's a metaphorical sense in which this applies to patent and copyright. Because you can think of the amount of land in the case of copyright as all of the books that could be written. So when I write a book and copyright it, I am not really reducing your opportunities. Because the chance you would have written that same book is essentially zero. But when I make an invention and patent it, I am reducing your opportunities because you might have invented it next year. So therefore, the existence of that book really is giving me, if you could give me the full value of the existence of an idea, of an invention, you'd be over-rewarding me. Because I would be getting both the value that I added by bringing it from a potential invention to an actual invention, and the value that already existed of a potential invention that somebody else could make. All right? So in that sense, you can argue that the inventor is, as it were, depleting a commons, and the author is not depleting a commons. And that provides a possible explanation for the puzzle, which you've read, because you've just read the chapter of my book, of why we give much longer protection for copyright than for patent. Now, there are other possible reasons, as I discussed, but that seems to me is one interesting one. And this goes back, I mentioned, I think, last time, the idea of rent-seeking, the idea that people will, in effect, waste resources if there are ways of my spending resources not to create but to transfer. And the classic article on this subject was written by Gordon Tullock, who I think may be still alive, I'm not sure. Very interesting, crazy guy. And his article was called The Welfare Costs of Tariffs, Monopoly, and Theft. And he was showing that the same argument, let's go back to a different puzzle. Why do we object to theft? We being economists, not moralists. All right? After all, we value, what do we ask, what's total value? Well, all right, I got 10 bucks left, you less, you got 10 bucks more, that looks like a wash. Why do we care? And the economist's answer is because the ability to pick my pocket means you will spend time and effort doing it. I will spend time and effort keeping my money in my shoe instead of my wallet so you can't do it. Both of those are deadweight costs. Both of those are costs coming from the fact that you are trying to make sure that some property becomes yours instead of mine, and I'm trying to make sure it doesn't. And if we have a better way of stopping it, like locking up thieves, then we can avoid those costs. All right, so that's the theft part of it. Monopoly, Tulloch pointed out that in addition to the deadweight cost that everybody had known about for 100 years, there's a different cost to monopoly. And the other cost to monopoly is that if I say, I'm a clever guy, I can see that in 10 years there's going to be a market for this product. And furthermore, this particular product is one where there's only going to be room for one firm. All right, it's a natural monopoly of some sort. Well, it pays me to make sure that I'm that one firm. And how do I do that? I start producing the product before there's enough of the market. Exactly like the homesteading case. I start out by developing my position as the provider of X, Y, and Z, of a word processor or something, in order that by the time it's profitable, I've staked my claim. Other people will realize it's not worth coming in because I've got a head start on them. Therefore, Tulloch says, I'm going to dissipate some of my monopoly profit in premature investment. And then tariffs, he says, look, economists have said forever, here are the costs. Tariff is a tax on imports, if you're not familiar with it, supported by domestic producers who don't want to compete with foreign producers, basically. And economists have argued for a long time that tariffs on net make countries worse off, for reasons I won't go into. And Tulloch says, yeah, sure do, but they make them more worse off than you think they do. Because you also have to allow the cost of all the money that the steel industry spends lobbying to get tariffs. That's a rent-seeking expenditure. They're spending money in order to make their customers worse off and themselves better off. That's a deadweight loss. So that's the classic article. I don't know if you can find it on the web or not, but if you can, you should read it because it's a fun article. Tulloch, I should say, was the joint author of the work for which Jim Buchanan got a Nobel Prize in economics. And I presume the reason Tulloch didn't was he offended too many people, but because he's crazy. But was crazy. Probably still is crazy. Very interesting, creative, odd guy. Colleague of mine a long time ago, who advised me that the one part, this is useful if any of you become academics, the one part of the submission process for articles that you can control is how long the article sits on your desk. So, let me then go on. Copyright versus patent, you've read the chapter, so you already know what I have to say, which is basically that in law, copyright is given easily for long terms, patent grudgingly for short terms, that for at least the traditional subject of copyright, there is no problem of depleting the commons, there's no rent-seeking problem because nobody else wants to write my book anyway. And furthermore, the transaction costs for traditional copyright aren't very high. Nobody's going to write my book by accident, so I don't have to worry about that. And if somebody makes a copy, I can easily prove that it's a copy, and therefore I can enforce the rule, or could until recently at least. Depletion, patents the other way around. Ideas have fuzzy boundaries. You can trespass without knowing it. You can argue because you think you didn't trespass and the owner thinks you did, and the court may get it right or wrong. And patent depletes something. So, and I should say, I keep saying traditional copyright, because copyright, as some of you know, has gradually expanded over the years so that it covers some things that maybe ought to be patented. All right, let me end up with a little bit about the death of copyright and about alternative ways of paying for producing stuff. And the reason why the death of copyright might be happening is because it's becoming harder and harder to enforce. A part of the story, which probably is in one of your readings for next week, though I'm not sure, is that a bit over 100 years ago, what was the great pirate nation of the world in terms of intellectual property? America. Because the U.S. did not have copyright treaties. So it was perfectly legal to pirate a British book in the U.S. Despite that fact, British authors not uncommonly made larger royalties, larger returns from their American sales than their British sales. Why? Because with the technology of 1900, there was a sizable first mover advantage because you were printing books by hand-setting lead type, which takes time and effort. So the procedure, as I understand it, is that I'm an author. I have a contract with an American publisher who agrees to pay me royalties. In exchange for that, I provide him the manuscript before the book is published in England, enough before so that when the first copy becomes available in England, he's got a stack of books ready to sell. And now no pirate can interfere with his market until the pirate has bought the book in England, reset the type, printed books over. So he gets the first, whatever, month or 2 months of sales, which is often a large part of the return. Now a pirate edition comes out. And so the legitimate publisher produces what was called a fighting edition. This is the lowest cost edition he can produce. He's got his lead type already set. And he's pricing it to try to make sure the pirate loses money. He's pricing it at a price at which the pirate will not recover the fixed costs that were involved in the original typesetting. And that mechanism seemed to work pretty well. So that's an interesting case where in about a century we've gone from a world where you could enforce copyright without copyright law to a world where it's not clear that you can enforce it with copyright law. And that's an example of the way in which technology changes the costs of enforcing and violating laws and thus what the actual effect of the laws is. All right, so suppose it happens. Then how do we pay people for innovation? How do they get paid? One method we've discussed already, you could have prizes. You could have the government could issue prizes. The government could say, we want a drug that does such and such, and we'll give $10 million to the first company that produces it. You could have private people, as with the SpaceX prize, who do it. But another possibility for inventions is first mover advantages. There's one of my favorite Kipling poems called The Merry Gloucester, which I recommend to those who like poetry. The speaker is a 19th century shipping self-made millionaire, dying, talking to his worthless son about how he made his money and about lots of other things. But one of the lines is, they piddled and piffled with iron. I'd given my orders for steel. Steel in the first expansions, it paid, I tell you, it paid when we came with our 9-knot freighters and collared the long-run trade. And they asked me how I did it, and I gave them the scripture text. You keep your light so burning a little ahead of the next. They copied all they could copy, but they couldn't copy my mind. And I left them sweating and stealing a year and a half behind. So that's one answer, that in some cases, being the first person is enough to give you an advantage that pays for doing it. There are other possibilities. One possibility, which is historically quite important, is patronage. If you read an 18th century or maybe even a 17th century English book, not uncommonly, the first page or two are a description of the most wonderful nobleman you've ever heard of, how wise and learned and generous, especially generous he is. And you know who's been feeding the author for the last 2 years. All right? So that one method then is that you write a book and you get paid for it by the person who you will praise and therefore give status to. You could do this today. All right? The obvious modern model, you probably wouldn't use individual rich people. You'd use firms. You could imagine that a popular songwriter writes a song, he makes it public domain, it's available for everybody to download, but at the beginning he says very briefly, this song was made possible by the generosity of Apple Computer Company. And Apple is willing to do it because that result is they sell another 100 Macintoshes to everybody in this room, I notice, almost. A few holdouts, but... So that would be a possible model. You could imagine that people will pay producers to produce ideas, inventions, books, whatever, in order that they can get credited with them. There's a sense in which the open source model is something like that, although that's one in which the credit is actually going to people doing the producing. But the open source model for software is a model without intellectual property, except that the open source contract itself is being enforced, and the open source contract says you can do anything you like with this software except make modifications and keep the modifications secret. The basic open source rule is you take Linux, you make any changes you like to Linux, but you are not allowed to then sell the changed version as compiled object code without making the source code available so other people can use it and make further modifications to it. All right? So that's a model. It seems to work pretty well. And it works, again, partly off status. I actually have a story, an open source story, by how I discovered the value of status. One of the leading figures in the open source movement is a guy called Eric Raymond, who wrote a very interesting book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. And he gave a talk at Stanford some years ago, and I attended. And I had interacted with him a little bit in an entirely different context. We have similar political views. And at the end of the talk, people are coming around to talk to the speaker, and I come up to him and I say, hello, I'm David Friedman. He looks at me and says, David D. Friedman? And I could just feel my status rise in that room. And I got a free Chinese dinner out of it, too, because the hosts were taking Eric out to dinner, so they took me out to dinner, too. So, but that was sort of a neat example. That is one of the things that matters to people, and therefore one of the incentives that, and I think the incentive for writing a lot of novels, is to be a novelist. All right, I think I'm out of time. Will everybody please return their copies of this so I know when my office hours should be, and somewhere in this room is a seating chart, which we're very lucky has all your names on it.